Good morning. One of the brightest spots of my tenure at our yeshiva has been my affiliation with Ora and our wonderful students from Josh Ross to my Talmid, Rabbi Michael Kaplan, to Jeremy Stern. And under the guidance of our teacher, Moran Rav Schefter Shlita, we've had many successful resolutions, and I'm honored to have been a part of maybe about a dozen gittin over the past 2 years. Like Rav Schefter, Gedolei Yisrael throughout the generations have always been concerned with the plight of the Aguna. My brief this morning is not to discuss any particular cases or the state of marital law in the American legal system. Suffice it to say that behind every case is a deeply complex personal relationship between a man and a woman. It's not always the woman who is the victim in the dissolution of a marriage. Gedolei Yisrael object, however, to the use of the Torah as a weapon in the struggle between a husband and a wife. Using the granting of a get as a means of extortion or as a tool of persecution perverts Jewish law. It's wrong in much the same way as a woman denying access to a man's children in order to exact financial concessions. I can't speak to the latter, as it's usually governed by civil law. I can, however, address the Aguna situation, since it's a feature of Jewish law and within our purview. One of the institutions of Jewish marital law that is most misunderstood is the Heter Meir Rabbanim. We find it curious, since it injects the actions of a large group of human beings, seemingly without specific textual authority, into the Torah law in a role not unlike a Sanhedrin. Our focus this morning is abstract and theoretical. We'll discuss how the Heter came about and what it was intended to do from a public policy perspective. We should not, however, and I cannot, forget the names and faces of Nashim Agunos Mesurvos Gittin, unfortunate souls as entitled to their independence as any other. There are human tragedies occasioned by the illicit abuse of the institution I'm about to describe, and it's fitting, I think, to express my resolve and the resolve of my colleagues to assist in the proper operation of Dinei Yisrael to the best of our abilities. Let me also say what I will not discuss: Hafkas Kedushin, so-called annulment of marriage, Kiddushin Al Tanai, conditional marriage, or the relative status of women in Jewish law and religious society. These are complex topics, and we'll be hard-pressed simply to cover one aspect of marital law. Also, Rabosai, this is a shiur, not a rally. I won't answer any questions or entertain any comments about specific cases. It's a time to rally, and there's a time to learn. Now's the time to learn. In the weeks ahead, there will be occasions to rally. In fact, the last time I was scheduled to speak about this topic, I had to ask to be excused so that I could answer the summons of Moran Rav Schefter Shlita to rally against the abuse of halacha through the improper arrangements of Heter Meir Rabbonim by a rabbi in Flatbush. I've stood in the rain outside this rabbi's house with other rabbi students and concerned Jews. Now, though, it's time to learn Torah and see where he is wrong. At the end of the 10th century, the Jews of Germany, France, and Italy, and all the surrounding population centers looked to a single figure as their leader. His name was Rabbeinu Gershom ben Yehuda. Tradition tells us that he was born in France, some say in Metz, around the year 965 CE. We know very little about his life. We do know that he studied and taught in Mayence. Most of the information we have about him is collected from citations by the Rishonim, including notably Rashi in his Perush to Shas and in his Tshuvos. Listen to how Rashi describes him in one of his tshuvos. It's in your sources. Rabbeinu Gershom Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha Sheheir Einei Gola V'Chulanu Mipiv Chayim V'Chol B'nei Golus Ashkenaz V'Kitim Talmidei Talmidav Heim. As you can see, just in these brief words, Rabbeinu Gershom was the acknowledged leader of the entire Jewish community in these Western European countries. Specifically mentioned are Germany, France, and Italy. Kitim is a medieval name for France and Italy in Chuvos. The honorific appended to his name, Maor HaGola, the light of the exile, pretty conclusively indicates his widespread authority. Now, what was the light by which this saintly leader illumined the entire Galus? It was through his enactments, called takanos in Lashon Chachamim. While the takanos attributed to Rabbeinu Gershon are many and diverse, including the prohibition against reading documents belonging to another, including mail, we'll focus on two in particular, both related to marital law. And they are, in fact, grouped under what is known as Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom. A Cherem is a communal ban, not to be confused with excommunication in other religions. A milder form of Cherem is Nidui. The difference between them is the Bach writes, in Yoredeya Siman Shin Lamed Dalet, is that the Cherem entails an actual curse of the violator. A Nidui is just a social ban. We're familiar with it. We're Matir the Avaryanim to daven with us Erev Yom Kippur, right? So Anu Matirin, right? Lispali Ima Avaryanim. Those are those that were in Nidui, and we couldn't go within Dalet Amos of them. Cherem is much more serious. As Reish Lakish explains in the Gemara Moed Katan, the letters of the word Cherem are Ramach, the number 248, representing the traditional count of the organs of the human body. So putting someone in Cherem is pretty serious stuff, since we're in fact praying for the death of the violator. So whom did Rabbeinu Gershom, Maor HaGola, consign to the category of sinners for whose death we pray? Those who are married to more than one woman at the same time? Those who divorce a woman against her will, and those who read another's mail. When halachic authorities refer to Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, it's these three takanos to which they refer. We're interested this morning in the first two. I'll let you deal with your own email. Bigamy and divorcing a woman against her will. The two appear to be related, don't they? But let's discuss them one by one first. Already in Talmudic times, there were authorities who opposed polygamy. Although the Gemara in Yevama Samach Hay follows the opinion that multiple wives are permitted, Rachmana Litzlan, it's important to note that this is only if the husband can maintain full responsibilities as a husband to each and every one of them. In our Makoros, I think it's number 6. In the case where the husband wants to prove that he's not the source of a couple's infertility. Amarihu, he says, Aziel, in si vitata v'ivdok nafshai. How about if I go and marry another woman and thereby submit myself to a test of my own virility? If I have a child with her, then it's clear I'm not at fault. Amar Rabbi Ami, Af bizo, even in a case like this, yotzi biyitain kesuba, sha'ani omer kol hanosei isha al ishto, yotzi biyitain kesuba. Rabbi Ami, already in the Gemara, says that one must divorce the first wife and settle the financial requirement of her ksuba prior to taking a second wife. Already here, we see opposition to the taking of a second wife. Rav Amar, Nosei Adam Kama Nashim Al Ishto, Vehu De Islei L'Mizanayhi. Rava, the decisive authority for the Gemara here, rules that one may marry additional wives, but he must still support all of them. There is no opportunity to jettison a wife without her settlement and this to move on. So we're talking already here in the fourth generation of a Babylonian Amoraim. We're finding opposition to the taking of a second wife. Furthermore, reading the Gemara very carefully, the dispute between Rabbi Ami and Rava is limited to the singular case of a man anxious to establish his own virility, or potency, I should say. This comes on the back of the halachic principle that the woman is more reliable in such a case given her physical role in the act of intercourse. So without the lab test that we have today, the authorities had to rely on anecdotal evidence from the woman about her sensations during intercourse, something we now know to be highly unreliable. In other words, the motive for taking a second wife in the Gemara's context is an exceptional one and not something that occurred regularly. Now we should note the Torah does not promote polygamy. It was a fact of life in the ancient Near East, and the Torah therefore regulated it as it regulates all aspects of Jewish life. I don't have to tell this audience that reading carefully through the Gemara, we don't find many instances, except through Yibum, of multiple marriage. The halacha strictly follows Rava here. And most important is his stipulation that the husband may not use the taking of a second wife to avoid his financial responsibilities to the first. It couldn't be clearer. This is very important. There is no halachic opinion, even a minority dissent, that one may take a second wife and stop supporting the first, including material support and conjugal relations if desired by each wife. That's already in Shas. It does appear that rabbinic authorities already frowned on maintaining multiple wives before Rabbeinu Gershom. So what did he do? He went the additional step and placed the one who did so in Cherem, threatening him that we would pray for his demise. Why? What prompted Rabbeinu Gershom to take the radical step of placing a cherem on those who might take a second wife? It appears that there had to have been at least a small group of people that would contemplate doing so. A widespread cherem is not something that would be done casually. So if you look at the Darkei Moshe at the beginning of Evin HaEzer, he provides two reasons for the cherem. The Darkei Moshe, of course, is the commentary of the Rama, the author of the Mappa on the Shulchan Aruch, who codified Ashkenazic Jewry's Piskei Din in response to the writings of the Mechaber in the Shulchan Aruch. The Darkei Moshe is his commentary, of course, on the Beis Yosef, just as his Mappa is his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The first reason that the Rama cites is in order to prevent the maltreatment of women by their husbands, who could simply add another woman to the household or threaten to do so. In this regard, then, the cherem to Rabbeinu Gershom should be viewed as a preventative measure against the abuse of the halachic system as a tool in the divorce process. This is the first reason stipulated in the Darkei Moshe, and the most common found in the Rishonim. The second, more practical, was to prevent kitata, serious domestic strife among wives and between wives and husbands. It may be unknown to the people in this room, but husbands and wives sometimes argue. Let's note these reasons and later relate them with some irony to the current practice of unscrupulous renegade rabbis in Flatbush and elsewhere. The Maram Shik Zatzal, the illustrious Talmid of the Chasam Sofer and author of hundreds upon hundreds of important tshuvos in the 19th century, relates the Takana directly to the Gemara in Yevamos that we just saw. Since Rava maintains that taking multiple wives is only permissible if one can support all of them, it may be that the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom is related to this special condition for multiple marriage. Even though the Psak HaSugya permitted it, it may well be that the policy issue here, the Maram Shik argues, was that the recognition that the condition might not be fulfilled. Rabbeinu Gershom instituted the ban since he feared that men would not be able to support their wives as required. So let's recap then. The halachic literature proposes three reasons for the cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom: to prevent the willful abuse of women by their husbands, to prevent domestic strife, and to prevent men accepting economic burdens they could not maintain. We will see that the abusive exploitation of this heter fails on all three counts. Whatever the reason, this heter had far-reaching effects among Ashkenazic Jewry. Now I'm certain that many of you have heard that the cherem has expired. Okay, so let's clear that up before anybody does something that they may regret. Some Rishonim, notably the Rashba, as cited by the Ma'arik, mention reports that the cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom was only effective until the end of the fifth millennium, a fancy way of saying the year 5000 on the Hebrew calendar. That would mean that the cherem expired in the year 1240. So incidentally, just in case anybody here doesn't know, that's a shortcut for calculating the secular equivalent of a year on the Hebrew calendar. You can be close depending upon whether or not a date falls after January first or not, by dropping the thousands and adding the remainder to 1240. In fact, we don't show the thousands when we display the Hebrew year. That's why you'll sometimes see on a calendar the year written with Lamed Pei Kuf after it. That means Leprat Katan, which means that we left off the thousands. So we leave off five thousands. So when we say Tuf Shin Ayin Leprat Katan, we mean the thousands were left off, the 5000. So really it would be Hey / Tuf Shin Ayin 5000, right? 770, right? So the 770 without the 5000, you add 1240 to it, 2010, right? We're before January 1st, so it's still 2009. Although the 5000 expiration is only a report that he mentions, and it's disputed among the authorities, it did gain wide circulation. How did it become an urban legend? It was reported by the Rama in the Darkei Moshe that we just read. The Rama there doesn't say that the prohibition is no longer in force, only that it's now an established practice in the Jewish community. What does this mean? It's only the cherem element that may have expired. He notes that we do not follow that opinion in practice. Now, this is very important. I'd like to emphasize it for your understanding. A cherem is a communal action. This particular cherem is identified with Rabbeinu Gershom. In many sources, however, it's called Takanos HaKehilos. Even if the specific action of Rabbeinu Gershon had a time limit, and that's by no means assured, the Kehilos accepted it as a meritorious practice, and it remains in effect forever. That's why authorities who lived after the year 1240 cite the Cherem again and again. The reason is either that they don't accept the report that it expired, or they recognize that it's a practice that's firmly accepted as binding by Jewish communities for centuries, with the exception of the Teimanim. So why put a time limit? Sorry? Yep. So why put a time limit on a piece of communal legislation? There are sound jurisprudential reasons within the halakhic system to do so. An answer is actually suggested by an interesting discussion in the Avnei Nezer, among other places, as to the difference between a siyag and a takana. A siyag comes to protect against the violation of an isur d'oraisa, and therefore its enactment is forever. A takana, on the other hand, comes to correct a public policy violation situation. So making it permanently effective would add to the Torah, which would be a violation of a law. The preferred method is either to renew it periodically or to recognize its binding nature as minhag. In either case, there is no halachic permission for you to take an additional wife. The designation of the cherem as takanas akilos also highlights, by the way, an important jurisprudential development in post-Gaonic halacha. The Rishonim and the Shute literature cite a body of regulations issued by local community authorities throughout the diaspora, and they need not deal with weighty matters like marital law. The Gemara in Baba Basra already notes the authority of the townspeople to regulate market prices, compensation to labor, and weights and measures. The Rashba, throughout his Tshuvos, traces the authority of local Jewish government regulation over individual Jews to the power of the Bez Din HaGadol over Klal Yisrael. The minority must submit to the majority. If Hefker Bez Din Hefker, if a Bez Din can expropriate property, then Hefker HaKehilos Hefker, so can a community. From the same Pasuk in Ezra. This theme is articulated again and again in halachic literature. Designating then the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon as Takanas HaKehilos has the force of emphasizing its authority in the sense that I just articulated. Now the second of the marital takanos then is the prohibition against divorcing a woman against her will. As we can see from the Mishnah in Yevamos duplicated here, Talmudic law does not invalidate a divorce against a woman's wishes. In fact, a man could do so even if he didn't have the financial wherewithal to meet the ksuba obligation and to pay any nidunya. Rabbeinu Gershon said otherwise. Even if a man wanted to pay the ksuba, he couldn't divorce his wife on his own account alone. Now let's note that Rabbeinu Gershon can add a prohibition. He does not and cannot take something prohibited by the Torah and make it permissible. Are the two takanos a unit to be understood together or two separate policy regulations? most authorities do see them as related. The Tshuva Sarashba, cited by the Ma'arik, explains the prohibition against bigamy as related to the improper treatment of women by their licentious husbands. He gives the same reason for the second prohibition. Men might cavalierly divorce their wives in order to pursue other women, or threaten to do so in order to deal unfairly with them. So this explanation makes the second takana a corollary to the first. The Rush has a fascinating take on the takana. He explains that Rabbeinu Gershom saw that the improper behavior by unscrupulous men was making it difficult for women, and he sought to redress the power situation by making it impossible for the husband to unilaterally divorce his wife, just as the wife cannot divorce the husband. Now, before anyone interprets this anachronistically as a feminist initiative to create identity between the two genders, let's understand that it was a response to improper behavior by husbands and that it had its limits. The Beis Din retained the right to force an unreasonable woman to accept a get in accordance with Talmudic law. The Rush thereby limits the applicability of the policy move, depicting Rabbeinu Gershon not as seeking to turn Jewish law on its head, but rather to protect women against maltreatment. We can see a deliberate misunderstanding of this point in the absurd claim by certain Misarvei Gittin in their pamphlets and websites against Ora, that our protest against the abuse of halacha is a feminist distortion of the Torah. I think we must now acknowledge that there are certain groups on the other side who would be astonished to hear our Rosh Yeshiva called feminists. As we've seen, it's just good halacha. Whether or not the two are actually one in purpose, the two takanos do work together, if you think about it, to reinforce one another. If one cannot divorce a woman against her will, one may threaten to take another wife in her place and effectively make her an aguna. If one cannot take a second wife, one may threaten to divorce the first wife against her will, thereby forcing her to accept unfair treatment. The two takanos are operationally related, if not in fact intended to complement one another. So just as Rabbeinu Gershom and the Kehillos were concerned for the potential aguna, they also were concerned that men not become the male equivalent. Once one requires the woman's consent to be divorced, what happens when she's unable to give her consent? What happens if through mental illness or debility, the woman loses the ability to make such decisions? In halachic parlance, this case is known as nishtates. She became a shota, lacking the mental ability to accept her get. Under the terms of Rabbeinu Gershom's takana, the man married to such a woman would effectively be chained. He'd be agun to her for the remainder of her life. Since he cannot divorce her, in fact, he may not even be able to divorce the Mina Torah if she doesn't have the mental capacity to preserve a get. Prohibiting bigamy leaves him no way out. How about if he hasn't fulfilled Piria Verivia yet? Or how about just allowing him to live happily? For don't we say, Hasharui below Isha, Sharui below Simcha. So in a case of mental incapacity, Rachmana Litzlan, the husband must continue to care for his wife, to provide for all her medical, clothing, and life expenses. And so he can't divorce her. He has to maintain her. In order to be fair to both of them then, the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom has an escape clause. If the woman could not be divorced because she was incapacitated, the cherem could be suspended. Because suspending the cherem was fraught with danger of abuse, the escape clause was made very onerous indeed. The heter had to be accepted by 100 different rabbanim in at least 3 different geographical jurisdictions. Let's refer to the fourth source, the Chelos Chuvos, the Maram Mirottenberg. Rabbi Meir ben Baruch Mirottenberg lived in the 13th century, and he flourished in France and Germany, where he became one of the most influential of Rishoni. He cited all throughout Tosfos and was the Rav HaMuvhak of the Rosh, the father of the Tur. Like Rabbeinu Gershom, he was a Paitan as well, and his kino on the burning of the wagon loads of the Gemara in Paris in 1244, Sha'ali Srufa, is still recited on Tisha B'Av. It's beautiful. V'acherem asher sam Rabbeinu Gershom shelo yisa ish shtei nashim ein lahatira ella b'meya anashim migimol malchuyos. The Mara mentions 3 provinces then within France, to which I'll return to the 3 provinces shortly. Gam lo yatiru osa ad sheyeru tam lahatir. Important. There must be an effective halachic rationale, a tam, for permitting the escape. Like the woman cannot accept her get, or she's disappeared, or it's impossible to live with her due to Isur. Just to escape responsibility or for spite does not qualify for a heter meya rabbanim. Notice that the Lashon here says meya anashim. In all the other sources, we find Meya Chachamim, for example, the Hagos, Asheri, and Yavamos, or the more prevalent, Meya Rabbonim, as a careful survey of the Shu'ut literature has demonstrated to me. Meya Rabbonim might mean, by the way, 100 community Rabbonim, whereas Meya Chachamim might just mean scholars. In any case, no one says 100 just men qualify. The accepted halacha is as the Noda B'Yehuda phrases it, 100 Rabbanim who are Re'uyim Lehora. Why? Because they must review the case and validate the decision of the Beis Din that's indeed a case that merits abrogation of the Cherem. They must be in at least 3 different states. We say like New York, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts would qualify. The Igros Moshe explains that the onerous process of collecting the 100 Rabbanim's assent to the Beis Din's psak is in order to dissuade the husband by making it difficult to accomplish. He finds an analogy in the Gemara, by the way. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says that the witnesses in a Sota case are driven by the Beis Din from place to place so that they may become confused and retract their evidence if they're not certain or they're lying. So because of the tremendous significance of their evidence, the court wanted to dissuade them if at all possible. So Reb Moshe Zatzal suggests the same rationale for the Heter Meir Rabbanim. The Beis Din then make the husband travel from place to place to secure the consent of 100 Rabbanim to the decision of the original Beis Din, which they must read, to allow him to take a second wife. This will certainly discourage the husband unless he's extremely dedicated and confirmed in the justice of his case. As the Bach makes clear, the requirement for 100 Rabbanim to agree makes escaping the Cherem neither easy nor Jeremy an act of secrecy. The Bach insists that the matter must be adjudicated by the greatest scholars of the time. The Meir Rabbanim then sign an agreement with the greatest of Batei Din. When might we not even require the Heter Meir Rabbanim? in a case where the woman's mental illness is so obvious and well known because she's been hospitalized for a long period of time with no clear prospects of recovery. Why the multiple jurisdictions? The Achronim explained that requiring the husband to secure the consent of rabbis in multiple jurisdictions prevents the situation in which a single great rav agrees and all the rabbanim in his area are subsidiary to him in authority and they go along with it. The Maharam Shik has another suggestion. Since the Takan itself was the product of Chachamim in multiple jurisdictions, it requires the same legal condition in order to abrogate it. In other words, not the work of a single great authority, but Takanas Akihilos. One last major requirement. Because the Heter Meir Rabbanim is only used in the rarest of cases, when a woman cannot accept her get, the Beis Din executes the get for the woman and holds it on her behalf until such time as she is able to accept it. So why has our teacher, Rav Schechter Shlita, asked us to demonstrate with him? Here's what's happening. Certain rabbis have been arranging bogus heterei meir rabbanim. Let's see where they fall short of halakha. And this is definitely going to get my name on a poster. One, this rabbi arranges heter meir rabbanim in cases where the wife is desperate to receive her get. She's not mentally ill or incapacitated in any way. All the cases that we protest that violate halacha are for women who are most anxious to receive their get. Two, the Beis Din that often decides these cases, to which the 100 rabbanim supposedly agree, is not a recognized Beis Din with any degree of eminence. In fact, there was some struggle for us to establish what Beis Din has been behind many of these fraudulent heterim. A renegade court in Muncie that is known for selling decisions and contains not one world-recognized name in Psak Halacha does not fulfill the condition for Heter Meir Rabbanim. The 100 Rabbanim are solicited in secrecy, the exact opposite of the purpose of the Heter. Passing a sheet of paper around a kollel in Brooklyn is not the process described by the major Rishonim, Achronim, and Poskim that we've cited. Suppressing the Heter so that it cannot be checked by anyone and verified is not acceptable. Four, assent to the case in Beis Din means verifying the facts by investigating the background. There is no discernible process of verification by the alleged signatories to the psak. The entire process is done in secrecy, if it's done at all. Five, accepting money for signing a heter meir rabbanim or exacting a fee from the husband for executing it is not in accord with Jewish law. Halacha does not offer piskei din to the highest bidder. We actually had the case where the sister-in-law of an aguna called up the sister of the aguna and said, "Didn't you know that the going price for a get is $150,000? Six, the authorities who are to arrange a heter meir rabbanim are to be acknowledged gedolim, operating as a freelance arranger of bigamous marriages, with only men who refuse the summons of recognized bate din as disciples, does not qualify one as a gadol. Now, lo gadolani v'lo ben gadol, but I've learned with gadolim and I know a gadol when I see one. One would hope that the rabbis who've caused such pain to a group of women and their families will decide that they do not want to be remembered in the public record for Heter Meir Rabbanim. I pray that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will soften their hearts and allow them to realize Lo Zo HaDerech. Until that day, we'll continue to demonstrate outside their homes and alert the community to the corruption of halacha that is occurring there. Some members of my family have asked me why I'm so determined to fight on behalf of Agunos. Are there not other cases that also have merit? A Jew, of course, should be sensitive to the plight of all Jews. A Ben Torah should be especially sensitive to the plight of the Torah. The perversion of halachas, Rachmana Litzlan, Elbona Shel Torah, an insult to the holy word of Hashem, perverting the Torah in the service of one's anger, is unacceptable. We've touched on the major features of the Heter. I thank you for your kind attention.
I can just ask your patience for one more minute. We could have one more word about the organization for resolution of Agunos, Mr. Stern. Also, just as an aside, if anyone needs a parking pass, I have more parking passes. We have more parking passes back. Fantastic. If I could just ask you for one more minute, stay in your seats. Thank you.
Thank you, Rav Glickman. Just to follow up with what Rav Glickman was referring to, as Rav Glickman mentioned, there are two rabbis in particular in Muncie who have been issuing, working together to issue these false Heterei Meir Rabbanim, and we are working on organizing efforts, a Kol Kore for Rabbanim from across the spectrum to sign on, and Baruch Hashem, we've been successful so far. Once we have that Kol Kore intact, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, Mr. Shem, is going to sign on, Rav Belsky is signed on, Rav Shechter is going to sign on, etc. So pretty big names. We plan on having a protest rally against these two rabbis in Muncie to expose what they've done. Rav Glickman actually gave this shiur about 2 years ago at Midrashat Yom Rishon against a rabbi in Brooklyn who is working with these rabbis in Muncie. And we had two protest rallies that were led by Rav Shechter against the rabbi in Brooklyn. Since we've had those protest rallies to expose what the rabbi in Brooklyn was doing in assisting men and extorting money from their wives in exchange for a get, we no longer hear his name anymore in the cases that we work on at ORA. We exposed him, people know that he's a crook, and therefore his name does not come up anymore in the cases that we're addressing. Unfortunately, we have about a half a dozen cases that we're working on in which, because of these two rabbis in Muncie, who are issuing Heter Meir Rabbanim to husbands, assisting them in extorting hundreds of thousands of dollars from their wives, in exchange for getting, we have a number of cases that we're working on because of them. So therefore, there's a sign-up sheet in the back. Please put down your name and email address, and you could receive updates from us about the efforts that we're working on against these two rabbis in Muncie, and also on behalf of the other Agunot that we're working on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rick Glickman. Thank you very much, Jeremy. We'll see everyone next week. Again, if anyone needs a parking voucher, I have extras.